And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. And today is May 27th, 2021. It is Thursday. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody. How are you?
Oh, it's a great day. Beautiful day here on the Eastern Shore. And preparing for a rainy day weekend, but oh well. So be it.
There's always Sunday and Monday.
Absolutely. And no rain on gold's parade today. So we had a great, actually, we had a great day. We had a big drop in gold this morning and had a nice little turnaround. The New York spot price aftermarket, you know, we're up a couple cents at $1,898. Silver, same kind of a day, up 20 cents at $27.95. Platinum was down, though, at $1,184, down 13. Palladium was up 67 at $2,857. The USDX today was back down below 90, 89.97. Crude oil was up 64 at 66.85. Paper markets today, I'm sure they were all positive. The Dow was up 139 points. Well, the NASDAQ wasn't, but the Dow was up 139 points at 34,462. The S&P was up 4 at 4,200. And the NASDAQ was basically flat, down a point, 13,736. See what the bonds did? Well, that popped. 10-year yield, 1.60. And Europe markets, half were down, half were up. Half was up, half was down. Germany and the FTSE were down. Asia, same kind of thing, a mixed bag for the paper markets. So kind of a strange day in the precious metals, with it turning, but gold is really steady and around this 4-month high. And, we have, these central banks are kind of, we'll be talking about this in a little bit, but, the 10-year treasury yields gain as much as 3% after earlier losses, but, which might have hurt gold for a little bit there for a while. But, so actually it was a good day in the precious metals. And Thursdays, as always, initial jobless claims. Of course, that dropped. I mean, when you have 8 million plus jobs out there that need to be had, you would think that this would drop. But so jobless claims totaling 444,000. This is a little better than what everyone was expecting, but not a whole lot more. The total represented a decline from the previous week's 478,000. Yet for the same period a year ago, jobless claims still totaled more than 2.3 million. Wow. And, so yes, we need to have some more improvement in the jobs picture, but I guess that will come slowly, but surely, maybe, and maybe not, Dave.
Maybe, maybe not, indeed. But slowly, I believe, for sure. And again, numbers not showing any kind of trend yet. They're up and down in the, in the weekly, in the new claims area. But continuing claims can edged higher again, rising to 3.75 million. It was an increase of 111,000 over the prior week. PNC chief economist Gus Faucher said the steady decline in initial claims over the past few months, as well as other unemployment data, suggests that the April report, listen to this, understated the improvement in the labor market. And you know, it's mainstreamers like that who just make me scratch my head sometimes, because I mean, I see where he's going, but I don't see that in the data. Now, along with the steady slide in the headline number that Melody just mentioned, the total of those receiving unemployment benefits tumbled by 900,000 to just shy of 16 million. But remember, that 16 million Americans who are still receiving some sort of unemployment benefit roughly 14 months after the pandemic started, and you know, had another roughly 6 months to that from when the economy really started to turn downward last fall. Now, most of the decline in that 900,000 came from a decrease in those getting benefits through pandemic-related emergency programs, the federal government. Of course, we know the enhanced benefits that Congress authorized or reauthorized related to the pandemic expire in September. Melody.
Well, you know, my favorite person, Janet Yellen, she's almost as favorite as my Larry Kudlow.
Oh, man. Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, I know. And you know what? She's changing from you have to, it's all based on the data, to let's spend some more money.
Yippee!
That's the call of the wild, the call of D.C. More money, more money, more money. So, you know, she's urging Congress to step up the spending, guys. Come on. Saying that the government is operating on a budget that is more than a decade behind the times. Is that what she really said?
Oh, yeah.
10 years behind the times spent? Oh, my. But anyway, her remarks to a House panel that has a large sway over spending, Yellen said that inflation-adjusted spending, you know, it's been stagnant for 11 years. Noting aggressive programs the Treasury already has implemented to carry the economy through the last year, she's asked for still more expansive fiscal policy across a variety of areas. Now, you know, her being the Fed chair for a couple of years and knowing where what she knows there, and we even had Jerome Powell telling President Trump at that point in time that there needed to be more fiscal and not coming from the Fed. So here I think she's kind of, you know, maybe supporting the Fed, Dave. You know, trying to help the Fed out a little bit, maybe.
Certainly, you know, certainly showing her her bias.
Yes.
Anyway.
She said, our team has done valiant work implementing these programs with the resources at our disposal. Yes, you're doing a great job destroying the value of our dollar. But we cannot continue to be good stewards of this recovery and tackle the new bodies of work that Congress assigns to us in the years beyond with a budget that was designed for 2010. Come on, baby, start spending. That'll really shoot our gold prices higher, right? Right, Dave?
Yeah, baby.
of course, her comments come before President Biden releases his first budget, $6 trillion. To
spending.
Be financed. Pardon?
On the spending side, anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
A tad
gosh.
Less on the revenue side, right?
I mean, the numbers are just unbelievable, Dave.
Yeah, you know, along with infrastructure, Yellen says stronger spending is needed for her department, Treasury, particularly in tracking financial crimes, community development projects, and in cracking down on tax cheats by the IRS. Yellen asked for 13 plus billion to fund IRS discretionary spending and 417 million to guide the American Families Plan. She noted that areas including domestic finance, economic policy, and tax policy have seen their budgets cut by up to 20% since 2016, saying, "The speed and strength of our recovery and our economy long term depend on a fully funded treasury. Now, the government ran a $3.1 trillion deficit last fiscal year, and already has accumulated just shy of $2 trillion in red ink through the first 7 months of fiscal 2021. You know, the annual deficit as a portion of GDP soared to nearly 15% last fiscal year, the highest level since World War II, with total debt held by the public approaching 100% of GDP. Yellen's testimony should come as no surprise to the longtime Washington observers and listeners to our program, dating back to her days as Fed chair. Which surprisingly, I think this is right. That ended in just 2018. Is that possible? Trump appointed a Powell in the middle of his term. I guess I'm forgetting short history, but recent history. And anyway, Yellen has long called the nation's fiscal path unsustainable, and has been advocating more spending at a time when interest rates are near historic lows and an economic recovery remaining quite incomplete and a lot uncertain. Strange things, Melody.
Yeah, my question is, they keep wanting to do more borrowing, more spending when interest rates are low, but those interest rates are going higher. So.
You know, that's like,
we don't care
what
about
that. Ask for. And therein lies the dilemma of not being able to look past the end of your nose when it comes to setting particularly fiscal policy in this country. It's been like that for a long time. We won't get into it today, but, you know, I think so much stems from, you know, just the pressure to fundraise, which means accepting money from special interests upon special interests. And it just leads to a very dysfunctional, inefficient system with, skyrocketing debt because no one can say no.
Very, very true. And eventually they won't have to say no. It'll say the system will say no for itself. Orders placed. Crash. Kaboom. Orders placed with U.S. factories for business equipment, this I guess is good, rose in April, and it's the most since last August. So, you know, positive month, capital investment, fueled by a broader reopening of the economy. And but it also makes me wonder if the supply chain was broken, maybe it was just people still ordering things, or did they decide to wait? And maybe, you know, it's really hard to tell these numbers that we get, what are true and what are, you know, which ones are. So it's so misleading.
Yeah.
And core capital good.
We know the answer to that.
Yeah. Core capital good orders, that category excludes aircraft and military hardware. It is seen as a barometer. Business equipment investments increased 2.3%. This was figures released this morning by the Commerce Department. Bookings for all durable goods or items meant to last at least 3 years unexpectedly decreased 1.3% from the prior month, reflecting declines in orders for military aircraft, motor vehicles, and again, blaming the global microchip shortage. But durable goods last 3 years, I mean, you're still talking about refrigerators. You're also, and I don't know how the microchip shortage would affect refrigerators and washers.
No, they're not. It's just the motor vehicles.
Yeah.
I think that was referring to. In fact,
yeah,
I did not see a breakdown of the other types, categories of goods.
Yeah,
like your home appliances.
Yeah, but I'm just looking at the overall decrease 1.3%. So that is, so you know, it does include those, but not. I agree with you as far as
My guess is that if you took out the declines in orders for the aircraft and motor vehicles that perhaps the other categories on the whole showed a continuing increase in orders, but not sure, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, let's see. What else about that, Dave?
And again, they're pointing to disrupted supply chains coupled with, you know, increasing demand, putting continuing upward pressure on prices. Unfilled orders for durable goods rose for a second straight month as well. Now, business spending on equipment advanced at a 13% annualized rate in the first quarter, and that helped the economy grow at a revised 6.4% pace, according to the Commerce Department. At the same time, personal spending was reported to have climbed at an 11% rate, Melody.
I watched a little bit of this because we had talked about it the day before about the big banks. Going to D.C. or at least
to get their butts handed to them.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all show.
Yes, indeed.
It's theatrics at its finest, and they all performed quite well, both sides of the aisle. and it was so funny. It's like, why didn't they even show up? It was all done, but I guess by Zoom or something, Skype. And I only heard a couple of them when they first opened. But it's funny, these banks, all they did was come out and talk about all the wonderful things they did during the pandemic. Well, we did this and we did that. We did this. We did that. But then they get criticized for not stepping up during the pandemic. I don't know. It was just ridiculous. So.
Yeah, you can look at it in a couple of ways. One, no good deed goes unpunished if you're the bankers, or on the other side of the coin, it's like actions speak louder than words. I don't know. Somewhere in between the surreality is, I guess.
But, you know, it's, and again, yeah, it's true. Wall Street's do profit. Banks do profit. It doesn't, you know, during good times and, you know, during bad times, they're still going to profit because they get bailed out. Too big to fail banks. So they got criticized for not doing enough. J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup. We can't be out of time already for this first segment.
Todd's telling us he is.
Tell me.
Show, Todd does
check
not
your watch, fall. Todd. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Bethann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Bethann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody the rest of the program. Melody's in the office. Give her a call at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. We're talking about the big banks being criticized for not stepping up during the pandemic. We'll get back to the banks in the next segment of the program. Stay tuned for that, please. But first, no surprise here for regular auto drivers, but gasoline prices are expected to be the highest for a Memorial Day weekend in 7 years. And that's starting tomorrow. And prices could stay elevated all summer, according to some, as Americans take to the road in an end-of-the-pandemic driving spree. The current average price for a gallon of unleaded gas, $3.04 per gallon, 16 cents more than a month ago and over a dollar higher than last year. That's according to the AAA. The Motor Club expects 37 million Americans to travel this weekend by car, a 60% increase over last year when the economy was still basically shut down. And we know gas prices jumped earlier this month, particularly in the Southeast, after Colonial Pipeline went offline for just about a week following a devastating cyber attack for which Colonial paid a reported $5 million ransom, possibly all of it in Bitcoin. Now, in some southern states, gasoline has jumped more than 20 cents per gallon as panic drivers have been filling their tanks and shortages shut down some stations. I've got a good friend who owns two gas stations in South Florida. He tells his brother, anyway, who I talked to earlier this week, that he's got both of them open, although he has seen long lines. Anyway, gasoline demand last week reached 9.5 million barrels a day. That's the highest since last year, which was just when the economy began to shut down. Patrick DeHaan, who heads petroleum analysis at the company Gas Buddy, said he expects more driving vacations this year since international travel is still difficult, even though a number of European countries are opening up their countries to fully vaccinated travelers. DeHaan said more of a concern, however, to him is that prices will further jump this summer if there are any refinery outages or hurricanes disrupting the flow of crude oil or refined products. Now, this is a tad of a turn, ladies and gentlemen. I will confess ahead of time. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. And this is a tad levity. This week's topic is music, culture, and war, and how the three of them are playing out in the country of Afghanistan. In a gated art gallery in the center of the capital, Kabul, a group of rappers dressed in baggy black shirts and skateboard pants are performing. Their rap, according to the writer, is distinctly Afghan. Beats mix seamlessly with the rubab and dambora, the classical Afghan instruments. Their freestyle is blunt, political, and a reflection of their, well, traumatic lives growing up in America's longest war on the verge of ending. Perhaps that's why the rappers are all of a sudden going viral internationally. They were born around the time the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to oust the Taliban from power way back in 2001, and they are entering their 20s now as the U.S. plans to leave. The rappers are the quintessential urban Gen Z Afghans. They are students becoming doctors and engineers who are also juggling jobs to support their families. They're building a hopeful future, too, while exploring their unapologetic identity in a country whose story has always been told from the outside through the lens of war, U.S. troops, Russian troops, what have you. Jawad Sezda from the Afghan rap duo AK-13 says hip-hop is important as it shows us a different peaceful world. When we are freestyling, he continues, everyone's just doing their own thing. There's no Pashtun, there's no Tajik, no Hazara, there's no fighting. The rapper's desire for peace is captured in their most recent release, a single called I Am, which has gained 500,000 views already on YouTube. I Am was released around the time the U.S. announced their plans to withdraw troops after 2 decades, even though the Taliban still control or contest more than half the country. Now, AK-13, Sezda, and Siraj Amiri also rap with Hadi Hashimi and Fareed Lalzad under the name LBR. In the song I Am, they collaborate with many other rappers in Kabul to produce what's called an epic protest anthem, which seems to directly address the Taliban in Afghan's national language, Dari, and says, you didn't let anyone live. Division was your practice in the country. We yearn for peace. But this has been decreasing its troops. Violence against civilians there has surged 40%, according to the UN. Recently, tragedy struck the rapper's own impoverished and predominantly Hazara neighborhood, where a school bombing killed 60, mostly teenage girls. Their hillside neighborhood in the west of the capital is no stranger to extremism violence either. In fact, their name AK-13 is playing the AK-47, the rifle, and their neighborhood name, District 13. Sezda says, our destiny is very similar to people of color in the U.S. His fellow rapper, Lazad, says they were heavily influenced by the birthplace of hip-hop, the South Bronx, and a number of its rappers. I believe in their ideologies, their fight for innocent people, Lazad said. Well, an interesting perspective of some Gen Zs from Afghanistan, a country nearing a significant transition. We can only hope that this thought of Taliban presence within their government be a motivating factor in keeping them active in the years to come. Their uneasy future is even embedded in the awkward language of the deal that says the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is not recognized by the United States as a state and is known as the Taliban. That, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, in his final markets newsletter today, Axios' Dion Rabelin tries to tell it like he feels, not how it's reported. So here in his words is Dion Rabelin's farewell. I mentioned this on today's program because Dion happened to be the source of a number of topics that we talk about on this program, as well as an occasional newsletter article and Friday blog. So Dion, here, this is in his words. He said, I'm not anyone important, but I read a lot of reports and I talk a lot to a lot of smart people, so I've learned a thing or two. And I believe our country is in trouble. It's not about a loss of morality or religion or liberals or conservatives or the current president or the last president. It's about a fundamental problem we have as a nation, a reckless imbalance of wealth. The people at the top have too much, and the people at the bottom don't have enough. This isn't a philosophical matter of doing what's right. It's a practical matter of doing what's necessary to uphold and maintain a consumption-based economy. Wealthy people aren't consumers. They buy more expensive things, yes, but as a percentage of their income, wealthy people save far more than they spend. Poor people, on the other hand, generally spend most, if not all, of what they have and save very, very little. As Donald Glover's character in the acclaimed TV series Atlanta points out, poor people don't have time for investments because poor people are too busy trying not to be poor. We're living in a world now where the wealthy have so much money, they literally don't know what to do with it. Corporations, they're hoarding trillions on their balance sheet, cash just sitting idle, largely because there's no such thing as a safe investment anymore. Editor's note, Dion. Not including gold, silver, that is. Now, globally, many bond yields are rising, but are still near record lows, meaning investors get compensated next to nothing, and they lose money for the privilege. The best high-yield savings accounts currently paying 0.5%, which translates to minus 3.7% in real yield because of the current state of inflation. On the other side, those who aren't asset holders haven't even benefited from the risk asset inflation that's accompanied housing, medical, and education price inflation for the last decade, because wage inflation hasn't even come close. Even in the roaring economy that was 2018, 40% of Americans had negative net incomes and were borrowing money to pay for basic household needs. And that trend has only worsened in the years since, and then accelerated at warp speed as a result of the pandemic and policy response. A consumer economy simply can't function when the consumers are too poor to consume and the wealthy don't want to. The problem isn't new either. We've been lurching toward this imbalance for years as corporations busted unions, moved jobs offshore, and muscled out independent small businesses aided by politicians who rewarded them with tax breaks and no-bid contracts for doing it. And when the levies inevitably broke and sent the country into recession, the Fed lowered interest rates to 0% and pumped more money into the economy so those same corporations and their top executives could reap further rewards. You might not have noticed, he continues, but this has driven up costs, but only in areas where the actual cost of the item is hidden or can be spaced out over time, like healthcare, housing, and education. Retailers can't raise prices, so it's almost entirely a race to the bottom. Nearly half of all new retail store openings that have been announced so far this year are from Dollar General, Dollar Tree, and Family Dollar. The obvious exception being luxury brands, which are selling products to the wealthy who have more money than they know what to do with. New companies today almost universally either lose money, free ride by offering a service that makes some other service cheaper, or sell something to large corporations or the government. Because consumers don't have to spend, many companies struggle to generate real profits. However, because interest rates are so low, if a company is big enough, it can just keep issuing bonds to keep itself afloat. That's why nearly a quarter of the largest public U.S. companies today are zombies, companies that don't even make enough money to pay the interest on their debt. The end result? For years, the Fed has been subsidizing large corporations, and recently the government has turned up its efforts to subsidize consumers. But subsidization is supposed to be temporary. It's become a way of life, the only way of life. So what's the solution? Rabouin asks. I don't know. This is him again. I just write the news. But it doesn't seem like there's much interest in finding an actual solution. Just printing more money, adding more debt, and putting more Band-Aids on the problem, end quote. Well, Dion, thanks for keeping us current on the financial-related events today, and best wishes in your future endeavors wherever they lead you. Now, if you have any reactions to his comments, please email me, daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. We'll read your questions or responses on a future program. Fannie Mae in the news again. Lower income homeowners could potentially save hundreds of dollars a month on their mortgage under a government refinancing initiative that starts next weekend. Sort of falling under the radar, I guess, unless, of course, you have a Fannie Mae loan. Fannie Mae is one of two government-sponsored and publicly traded enterprises that buys and sells mortgages, will open its Refi Now program on June 5th. It's meant to help an estimated 2 million homeowners lower the interest rate they pay on their mortgage and therefore the amount they pay monthly. Households earning 80% or less of their area's median income are generally eligible if they can meet some other requirements. A Fannie Mae statement about this said, many homeowners in lower income brackets may believe they can't afford to refinance, be convinced they won't qualify, or be unaware of the potential monthly savings. Well, with mortgage rates reaching historic lows in 2020, refinancing activity hit roughly $2.6 trillion for the year. That's according to Freddie Mac, the other government-sponsored agency that buys and sells mortgages. That marks the highest annual total since 2003, when $3.9 trillion in refinancing was recorded. The average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is currently 2.72%. That's according to the real estate site Zillow.com. For a 15-year loan, the average rate is just 2.08%. According to Fannie Mae's Economic and Strategic Research Group, the 30-year rate is expected to average 3% through the end of this year. Ziggy Johnson of mortgage lender Better.com said, I think this will have a huge impact for a lot of people. Anything that lowers mortgage payment frees up money for other things. And that music says we're going to free up a few minutes of important messages that we hope you'll stay tuned for. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Fallon. We'll be back in a few.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. PNCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hello, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen here for another 15 minutes. Melody's in the office at 1-800-375-4188. Now, listeners, I generally like to stay away from explicitly politically partisan stories, but when they affect the running of the country, I think they at least bear mentioning. And this one falls under the category of please don't shoot the messenger. Former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill is apparently under consideration for a major ambassadorship in Western Europe. Wow, really? Not saying which right now, if it's the European Commission, European Union, or particular countries. In any event, it's another sign that Joe Biden's apparently going to tap party allies over big dollar donors when he starts to name his political ambassadors as soon as next week. Not sure which of those is worse, but it seems like it's often a matter of choosing a broken arm or a broken leg. Now, McCaskill is reportedly to be joined in the diplomatic corps by controversial former Chicago mayor and early Obama chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, who's apparently been promised ambassador to Japan. And that's going to raise some eyebrows for sure, even within the Democratic Party. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, who's headed for India, and Tom Nides, who's a personal Biden confidant and a former deputy secretary of state, who's in line for Israel. Cindy McCain, widow of John, the late great, is expected to be the ambassador of the World Food Program in Rome. And Ken Salazar, who was President Obama's interior secretary, and a former senator from Colorado, is preparing to go to Mexico. Last but not least, career diplomat Nick Burns, a likely choice, they say, for China. Interestingly, Biden's also said to be considering former Republican senator from Arizona, Jeff Flake, who endorsed him at the Democratic convention. Flake is an ambassador of some unnamed country. Now, a former senator of Connecticut, Chris Todd, reportedly turned down an embassy offer and will instead be available for discreet diplomatic missions as one of Biden's oldest Senate friends. Now, Biden will likely draw, it said, on political allies and donors for less than a third of the 190 or so available ambassadorships. The remaining 70% will go to career Foreign Service officers, which I believe is the way to go. Now, I'm going to get back to yesterday's Senate Banking Committee hearing, the fiery hearing. On the one hand, if you, like me, have a strong disdain for our too-big-to-fail banks, then you probably get some amount of pleasure seeing their CEOs getting dragged before congressional hearings, if only to see them getting chewed out. However, in the long run, those fierce gripe sessions, as they really are, you know, the ones where the typical big bank CEO trudges to the Hill to knowingly get their butts handed to them by one grandstanding senator on TV or a rep or another. And they do little to change policies and practices that really matter to the little people out there like you and me. Nevertheless, it's still important, I believe, to know what's being said and promised by both sides, if for no other reason than to hold them accountable down the road. Senator Sherrod Brown, who chairs the Senate Banking Committee, opened yesterday's hearing with some blunt words about the mega Wall Street banks. And these are his words. Now, like most Americans, I want businesses to make money, and I don't mind that bankers are rich. Some people are going to be wealthy, and that's fine. Here's the problem. Under the current system, Wall Street profits no matter what happens to workers, because those profits now come at the expense of workers. And your banks are the ones that largely built that system. He continued, we often hear about the invisible hand, but the economy isn't physics. It's not governed by scientific laws outside our control. It's made up of people making choices about our values and the society we want to live in. The invisible hand doesn't lay off workers. The invisible hand didn't invent credit default swaps. The invisible hand doesn't decide to invest in private equity firms that buy up mobile home parks in Iowa and across the country and jack up the rent. Your banks, your lobbyists, your fellow CEOs, at some point, the other largest companies, you all make those choices that dictate how our economy works. Wall Street built this system, and they didn't build it for everyone. They built it for themselves, unquote. Now, Senator Mike Rounds, remember the other side of the aisle from South Dakota, who lists the Mortgage Bankers Association, UBS, American Bankers Association, and Citigroup among his top 20 largest campaign donors, urged his colleagues to stop disparaging the banks, saying this, I'm quoting, before the Banking Committee ties itself up in knots about any of the controversial issues on the table today, I'd encourage my colleagues to keep in mind that we're all Americans, as are the firms who are represented here. We have a collective and strategic national interest in having a team of banks that are globally active and international leaders, but who are, above all, American. The last thing that any of us should want to see is a global banking system run by the Chinese government. And that's the road that we'll be continuing traveling down if we keep disparaging these firms or unfairly gold-plating international banking standards while China, Japan, and others run circles around us. Unquote. Perhaps the senator from South Dakota hasn't been paying attention. As we reported on Tuesday's program and at other times throughout the last few years, that largest U.S. bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, is a five-time felon since just 2014. And Goldman Sachs appears to be attempting to play catch-up, notching two felony counts in its belt last October. Citigroup, which received the largest bailout in global banking history from 2007 through the middle of 2010, pleaded guilty to one felony in 2015. And where to even start with Wells Fargo, which has worked hard over the years to screw its customers, its employees, and yes, the U.S. taxpayers to boot. But despite sporting rap sheets that spark envy among organized crime groups, Senator Rounds doesn't want Congress disparaging fellow banks because somehow having criminally inclined megabanks in the U.S. gives Americans a leg up on China. Apparently, Senator Rounds is too busy counting his campaign windfalls from the banking sector to recall that it was these same too-big-to-fail banks who caused, through their corrupt activities, the largest economic disaster in America in a mere but fading 13 years ago. The largest since the Great Depression. That economic collapse was the biggest threat to the national security of America since the 1930s, and these banks remain the gravest national security threat to our economy, despite what the Fed would have us believe. Now, apparently, Sherrod Brown was not intimidated by Senator Rounds to say something nice about the Wall Street banks. After yesterday's committee hearing concluded, Brown released this statement, which said in part, Wall Street is on notice. The days of these banks and their allies controlling this committee are over. The countries that came before us are the most powerful economic actors in the country, and the signals they send to other companies influence workers at companies all over the country, not just their own employees. They can't say they're focused on lending to small businesses and growing the economy while spending billions on stock buybacks. They can't say they put customers first while charging them overdraft and late fees during a global pandemic. We need an economy that reflects our values, not Wall Street's. These CEOs have a lot of work to do, unquote. On the one hand, amen to that. On the other, though, it's time for all the talking to turn to action. Please, will someone just hold these people accountable? Will someone please change the policies and make it harder for these banks to get so close to doing our country in one more time in the world? Now, one European investment firm is warning investors that central bank monetary policy and government spending are reaching a tipping point, putting the global economy on the cusp of a new decade of higher inflation. In their latest research, Incrementum AG fund managers Ronald Peter Stoferly and Mark Valick reiterated last year's call that gold prices could push close to $5,000 within the next 10 years. However, they added that the inflation risk is growing such that gold prices could nearly double that within the decade. In their annual In Gold We Trust report, they said if the decade was plagued by stronger inflation, a price of $8,900 an ounce could be expected at the end of the decade. But with the monetary economic climate change that we're witnessing this year, the risk of inflation is growing visibly. Meanwhile, taking a more short-term focus, the firm sees gold prices pushing to new record highs by the end of this year. According to Options Market Positioning, the firm said there's a 45% chance that gold will hit a 52-week high in December, which means a minimum of $2,071, and only a 5% chance of falling to a 52-week low. That's certainly encouraging. Now, although the world is awash in uncertainty and turmoil as nations continue to deal with the pandemic, Incrementum said that the most significant factor for financial markets this year remains the growing inflation threat. Why? Well, in their words, central banks maintaining their ultra-loose monetary policies to support their economies around the world. Stoferly and Valick say, in our opinion, we're currently only in the early stages of this inflationary development. Quite different perspective than the Feds, who have been saying that this inflationary turn is temporary. Now, although inflation is rising, the investment firm warned investors that another shoe could still drop as the global money supply velocity remains fairly low. They said the looming threat will grow even larger as consumers start spending the money that they hoarded during the pandemic. Not only do Stoferly and Valick see the inflation threat growing, but they noted that evolving technology and the inevitable development of a central bank digital currency will add a new layer to financial repression around the world. Now, let's see. Remaining a minute or two we have in today's program, evidence is growing that the U.S. is entering a period of intense competition with China. We've seen this growing for a couple of years now, and it's coming as the government running the world's second biggest economy becomes ever more tightly controlled by its president for life, Xi Jinping. Kirk Campbell, who's the U.S. coordinator for the Indo-Pacific Affairs on the National Security Council, says rather bluntly, "The period that was broadly described as engagement has come to an end. U.S. policy toward China will now operate under a new set of strategic parameters, and the dominant paradigm is going to be competition." The sharp comments were among several signs of fresh tensions between China and the U.S., even as U.S. Trade Rep Catherine Tai and Chinese Vice Premier Liu He held their first phone call. At the same time, President Biden announced that he had ordered the U.S. intelligence community to redouble its efforts to determine whether the COVID-19 virus had escaped from a Chinese lab. Chinese embassy in Washington dismissed the inquiry as a smear campaign and blame shifting that would hurt efforts to prevent future health crises. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said, quote, "It is wrong to define the relationship with competition because it will only lead to confrontation and conflict." That's a mode we've been in for some time. The South China Sea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and now, you know, this. It's an interesting world. It's a dangerous world we live in, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure you've got plenty of gold and silver in your portfolio. That's all we have for today's program. It's the end of another week, TGIF. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks to Todd for I'm Dave Allen. Have a great weekend, ladies and gentlemen, and please, please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I'm not really a wealthy man.